Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. The Queen of Soul was laid to rest today. Over 1,000 members of the public were invited to attend what was to have been the private funeral for Aretha Franklin today. People lined up around 3 o'clock in the morning to secure a seat at the regal funeral worthy of their queen. The Franklin family decided to let fans participate in the funeral so long as they were appropriately dressed. The funeral was a star-studded affair as former Attorney General Eric Holder, Smokey Robinson, and President Bill Clinton spoke, and Stevie Wonder and other musician giants performed. That powerful, beautiful, and soul-filled voice has been silenced. May she forever rest in peace. NAFTA talks between U.S. and Canada will continue next week. Trade negotiations between the United States and Canada headed down to the wire today as both countries struggled to make concessions on their priorities, raising the prospect that talks to salvage the NAFTA agreement could falter. The U.S. and Canada failed to meet a Trump administration Friday deadline for reaching a new trade deal to replace NAFTA, but agreed to continue talks next week rather than break off negotiations. The Trump administration had set a deadline of today to strike a deal with Canada, threatening to move ahead with a bilateral trade pact with Mexico if an agreement between the countries could not be reached. U.S. and Mexican officials say they want to have the deal signed by Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, whose term ends November 30, rather than risk agreements being reopened by his left-wing successor, Andres Manuel López Obrador. But after failing to meet the Friday deadline with Canada, the Trump team signaled flexibility and that U.S. trade talks could extend beyond today's deadline and still be done in time for Mr. Trudeau to join Messrs. Trump and Peña Nieto for a late November signing ceremony. Mr. Art of the Deal has hit a snag. It's not as simple as he told us it would be. The NAFTA snags are in light of Donald Trump threatening to pull out of the World Trade Organization. President Donald Trump has threatened to pull the U.S. out of the WTO in a new attack on one of the pillars of global economic governance. Quote, if they don't shape up, I would withdraw from the WTO, Trump said in an interview with Bloomberg News. His warning comes as the deadline looms with the NAFTA deal and a decision on expanding tariffs on Chinese imports. While Trump has previously demanded better treatment from the WTO, amid complaints that it infringes on U.S. sovereignty and the U.S. does not always prevail in dispute settlement cases, the president's explicit threat to withdraw will ratchet up tensions over the Geneva-based body to a higher level. Now that the NAFTA talks have been extended, we'll see what happens with the WTO rhetoric. Chinese President Xi and PLA could join North Korea's National Day Parade. Speculation is rising that Chinese President Xi Jinping, possibly accompanied by an honor guard of People's Liberation Army troops, will appear alongside local leader Kim Jong-un at a symbolically important parade in Pyongyang next month. At a time when Washington has unleashed a trade war with Beijing, while the denuclearization process agreed between Kim and President Trump in Singapore at their June summit appears to be stalled, the appearance of the Chinese leader and elite PLA troops would send a significant cross-Pacific message about Sino-North Korean amity. That's not the message nor the optics that Pompeo and Bolton want to see. You are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Mumia Abu-Jamal's appeal request has been continued. We talked about this on Tuesday. The former Black Panther, who has spent 29 years on death row following his conviction in the 1981 shooting of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner, is petitioning to throw out the previous appeals and file a new appeal. To get insight into these latest developments, we turn to my first guest. She is the Baruch College Professor of American History and documentarian with Big Noise Films, filmmaker of the powerful documentary on Mumia, Justice on Trial, Dr. Johanna Fernandez. Welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me back.
Thank you so much for joining us. So help us understand now where we are. This, to me, is not the desired result that I think people wanted to walk out of the courtroom on Thursday, having heard that this is going to be continued to October. But at the moment, I would call it a draw. And a draw, I think, in this case, is a win. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think it's more than a draw, and it's definitely a win.
Okay.
For the continuance. So Mumia's attorneys asked for a continuance because a new document emerged earlier this week that, again, points to the bias of the judge, Ronald Castile, who reviewed Mumia's appeals and denied it because of his conflict of interest, because he had previously been the DA of Philadelphia. And based on a new Supreme Court ruling, Williams versus Pennsylvania, you cannot be both judge and prosecutor, and he should have recused himself. Now, the prosecutor, the current DA, is arguing that Ronald Castile did not have a significant involvement in prosecuting Mumia's case when he was DA. But all of these documents, some of which have been lost, which are surfacing, suggest otherwise. And so our lawyers got a hold of this new document, and they realized that they needed to do some research, and they needed to prepare a different argument than they were looking to present now with a lot more ammunition.
The reason I called it a draw was because the decision that came out of the court was not to grant a new trial, and it wasn't a decision to deny a new trial. And so that's why I termed it a draw. Talk about the importance of the document that actually mysteriously found its way into court, because isn't this a document for a very long time Castile had said didn't exist, and a number of prosecutors and whatnot said that this document just did not exist, and all of a sudden now it appears in court?
Well, that's another document.
Okay.
So there's another document that the DA's office somehow disappeared or lost that they couldn't find. But this is yet another document, a different document that surfaced. And this document has Castile's, you know, is on Castile's head. Letterhead when he was DA of Philadelphia, and it's a letter written by one of his assistants, an ADA, an assistant DA, to a politician, a congressman, a state representative, Fisher, way back when, essentially telling Fisher or asking Fisher to pursue the certain execution of 12 people. And at the top of the list is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Sounds like bias to me.
Sounds like bias to you.
And also, wasn't Castile overheard saying that he was going to assist the prosecution in executing the didn't he say that?
Well, it wasn't Ron Castile. There are quite a number of judges in this case.
Okay.
It was Albert Szabo, the original judge in the convictions part of the case.
Okay.
Early on, who was overheard telling another judge, he was overheard by his court stenographer, say precisely what you said. Now, Ron Castile, he reviewed the appeals that Mumia presented to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, essentially outlining that precise statement that the original judge, Albert Szabo, was racist and prejudiced, among many, many other violations. So Ron Castile was a judge in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, in the appellate court, hearing Mumia's appeal, claims for violations. And he denied all of the claims that Mumia presented to that court.
You know, this has been 29 years that Brother Mumia has been on death row. To say that this has been an incredibly contentious issue would be probably one of the greatest understatements ever made in the world. You know, call me Captain Obvious. But with the details that we know and have known for years, it has always boggled my mind how so many people could be so wedded to the idea that a new trial is not warranted in this case. I have just always been baffled at how someone could form their lips, short of Officer Faulkner's widow. I can understand her position, but short of that, I don't see how people couldn't look at this and say there has been incredible travesty here and this needs to be re-litigated.
Yes, exactly. And yet, you do not overstate the matter. This is an incredibly contentious case. And so many politicians in Pennsylvania have essentially used this case and his execution as a stepping stone to higher office, that the reason why so many politicians, all politicians in Pennsylvania, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, the reason why they are not for a new trial is because they're going to be exposed when this goes to trial because of all of the violations in the case. This is a case that the cops have their hands all over. 15 of the cops who were involved in collecting evidence in this case were convicted and tried later for corruption and tampering with evidence to obtain convictions. This for some reason, Mumia's case represents something that the police is scared of, that threatens the police and the state. This is a battle that we have to fight out. And if Mumia's case goes to trial, the entire city of Philadelphia and its establishment, the police department, will be on trial.
I believe if this case goes back to trial, the entire United States government will be on trial, because we then have to talk about other political prisoners, such as Imam Jamil Al-Amin. We have to talk about why Assata Shakur languishes in Cuba. And if you could, just in a couple minutes we have left, if I'm off base here, then let me know. But if I'm not, if you could explain to my audience the linkages here and something I said as we were wrapping this up on Tuesday, which was, once the government gets their hooks in you, once they decide that you are a threat to the status quo, they don't let it go, a la Imam Jamil Al-Amin.
Right. You are absolutely right. Essentially, Mumia is a former Black Panther. Jamil Al-Amin, A-Trap Brown, was one of the fiercest Black power leaders of the 1960s. Assata Shakur, former Black Panther. Jalil Al-Amin, who's in prison, former Black Panther. So the federal government under COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI, launched a homicidal campaign against the Black Panther Party and imprisoned many Black Panthers. And so even though the United States government denies that it has political prisoners, Mumia is one of many. And yes, this is going to raise the fact that someone like Mumia has a 1,000-page FBI record that began when he was 15. And one of those documents has the word dead written on the back.
And one of the things, and to close this point, one of the things that I think is imperative for the audience to understand is the power of empire. And what empire cannot tolerate is successful resistance. Empire must squash resistance at every turn. And that through the COINTELPRO program, and now I believe it's still engaged in just through other tactics and means. But this is what I think will actually be on trial, which is why the government is doing everything in its power to see to it that Mumia dies incarcerated.
At the end, at the height of the Vietnam War, the United States was being challenged fiercely by the Vietnamese abroad. The Black Panther Party was challenging U.S. empire, American capitalism domestically. You're absolutely right. That is something the government forgives, and it's been more than 60 years, and we still are seeing the fallout of that with the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, Jamil Al-Amin, Jalil Muntakim. Yeah, the list is endless. And absolutely, I could not have said it better myself.
As Gil Scott-Heron said, the endless list that won't be missed when at last America is purged. Dr. Johanna Fernandez, thank you so much for coming back so quickly. I'm glad we have something positive to discuss in this case. And if you don't mind, I'll call upon you again when we need to bring this issue to the forefront.
Absolutely. October 29th is the next court hearing, and we really need people out in Philadelphia.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is much more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and this is Friday, so that means it's panel time. My first panelist is a journalist, analyst, and political commentator whose voice you hear regularly on this program. He is Caleb Maupin. As always, Caleb, welcome back.
Sure. Glad to be here, as always.
We are also joined by author, political analyst, and he's the host of the weekly Hutchinson Report on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and the Pacifica Network. His latest book is Why Black Lives Do Matter, and he also has another new book out, The Kavanaugh Court, which we will get into in a few minutes. He is Earl Ofari Hutchinson. Earl, as always, welcome back.
You know, it's always a pleasure, Wilmer. Always.
And the next voice is a voice that you've heard on the show. This is his first time on the panel, multimedia journalist, and who has contributed to a number of radio and television and online outlets. He is Ray Baker. Welcome back, Ray.
Dr. Leon, glad to be in the number.
Thank you, man. So let's start with the results of the Arizona and Florida primaries. And are there signals going forward? The most closely watched race was the Republican primary for the Senate seat vacated by retiring Senator Jeff Flake. And then we also had in Florida the upset Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gilliam. He now stands against the Republican Ron DeSantis. Let's start with Caleb. Your thoughts on the results from Tuesday evening?
Well, there's no question about it that the centrist wing of both major parties in the United States is on the defensive. Not only do we have the recent results, we've got Cynthia Nixon here in New York running for governor against Andrew Cuomo. She came out of the debate recently, hot as possible. I mean, people were on her. Her poll numbers are going up.
Man, she stomped Cuomo, didn't she?
Oh, I mean, if you watch, it was like, it was like we saw a machine politician facing off against a political professional in no way prepared for what was coming. I mean, that was quite a debate. And whether it's the Democratic Socialist wing of the Democratic Party or the America First, protectionist, Steve Bannon wing of the Republican Party, the mainstream kind of, I guess you could call it neoliberal economics, militaristic neoconservatism, foreign policy consensus that seems to have dominated both parties, is on the defensive. It's facing a far-right opposition in the Republican Party. It's facing a far-left opposition in the Democratic Party. Americans want change in red states and in blue states, and our politics are intensifying, no question about it.
Earl, your thoughts?
Pretty much the same. You're seeing both wings of the party, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. I say both wings of the same party because at times it's hard to make a distinction between the centrist part of it, of both of those. But you do have an ascendant left side of the Democratic Party and a continuing surging side of the right side of the Republican Party. Now, when we look at Florida, I think Florida was pretty much the most intriguing for me. You have the mayor of Tallahassee, Andrew Gillum, and he was an upset winner. I mean, he wasn't expected to win. I mean, there were established Democrats there in the Democratic primary that were front runners. And they were the ones that were slated to win. However, he came out. He ran a great campaign. He went all over the state. He touched all the right buttons. He had Bernie come in. He endorsed him. He campaigned hard for him. He mobilized the grassroots. He really got people stimulated. And he did something else, too, that the Democratic Party has to pay attention to. Got a lot of young people involved. If you saw on campaign close night, you saw a lot of young people across every spectrum that was there. So that's a clear signal to the Democratic Party that, yes, people do want change, first of all. The second thing is how to get young people engaged and how to get them out to vote. I mean, that's been a continuing problem. So Gillum, I think, is a great, great hope for the Democratic Party, and there's a message in his win. On the other side, the lines are clearly drawn. First we saw it in Georgia, and now we're seeing it in Florida. I mean, you got a stone right winger, makes no pretense about it on the Republican side, and you've got a Bernie-style progressive on the Democratic side. Florida is going to be the titanic struggle above all of them, simply because Florida has decided so many elections, as we well know, and because it's so pivotal, the GOP is going to literally bet the bank on DeSantis in Florida to try to knock Gillum out of there and keep that state. On the other side, we'll see how much the Democratic Party, the centrist wing, and the progressives, how they can come together, coalesce around Gillum to make what should be and hopefully will be a major, major dent in this right-wing surge, getting Florida back.
Ray, your thoughts?
I think I can't add anything unique to those particular races. So what I would ask all of your listeners to do is to step back and take almost a helicopter panoramic view. What we've seen some in the Democratic Party do dating back to 2016 is run candidates where you could reasonably say, well, you don't want to vote for the other guy being a Republican, but not necessarily providing candidates that the base or the party could get excited about. What we had in Florida that was noteworthy was that Andrew Gillum was a candidate people went to vote for, as opposed to not vote against. And so we saw it when we saw John Ossoff and six in Georgia in that special election. We saw it with Hillary Clinton, obviously, in 2016. Democrats have been running candidates where they would hold up the Republican for as racist, as xenophobic, as sexist, or whatever it may be. And they would tell the voters, you don't want to vote for that person, do you? And time and again, American voters, perhaps to the disappointment of some folks, have been saying, yes, yes, I do want to vote for that person. So what we now have to see is that if Democrats run candidates that people actually want to support, as opposed to saying at least he or she is not them. We might see a groundswell in turnout. The important thing I think Brother Hutchison points out about Florida that will be important to see, and I think we can also mimic this to Georgia, although that's not one of the races you talked about. Yeah, I think it is one where we have a Trump conservative versus what we are seeing as at least an identity politics person from the left. How bad does the GOP want to win? We will see by how much they try to suppress Black and poor and Latino and elderly voters, those voters who would otherwise turn out for Democrats.
Two things, Ray, that I think you're spot on. First of all, both Andrew Gillum as well as Andrea Cortez, as well as there's a woman who's running in the state for state Senate in New York. They're running for Medicare for All, single payer healthcare system. They're running for a minimum wage of $15. They're running to raise the corporate tax. These are the things that they're running on. These are the platform planks that they're running on. And to your point, they're just not running against anything. And also, I found it very interesting in Arizona how Martha McSally, the Republican, current sitting senator, member of Congress, who has a very similar record to John McCain as being a former fighter pilot and all that kind of stuff. She ran as far away as did the others. They ran as far away from John McCain as they possibly could. And I found that to be very interesting. Caleb, quickly, any thought on those two points? And then we'll move on.
Overall, it follows the same trend that we've been commenting on about the growing change and the kind of distance between the centrist policies that have defined U.S. politics for so long and the way the American people feel. I mean, people are rejecting the status quo. And in red states, they're rejecting it by moving further to the right. And in blue states, they're rejecting it by moving in a more left-wing direction. But then that's not exactly, there are a lot of, conservatives in blue states who themselves are moving in a different direction as well. We've got a lot of leftists in conservative and red states that overall U.S. politics is escalating. And I think access to information has a lot to do with it. The fact that people can have access to political ideas they may not have seen before. They're not just reading their local paper. They're not just watching one or two stations on television. They're not just watching, the cable news world. But now with the internet, people have access to all kinds of information and they can make up their own minds. They can analyze things. It's a lot of myths that were widely believed at one time have been busted. So we're living in a new world. And I think, for a long time, U.S. society was kind of defined by kind of an apolitical atmosphere where people just didn't really think about politics except, at the time of a presidential election. And then it was a battle of personalities. Do you like this guy? Or do you like the other guy? But things are changing. And I think that people are becoming gradually, it's certainly not what a lot of people would like. There's certainly plenty to be frustrated about. But people are becoming more politically engaged than they've ever been in my lifetime. I mean, I'm only 30, but I'm shocked at how politically engaged people are.
Earl, before you respond to the last point I made and to what Caleb just said, I want to also throw in a point you were talking about, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party being two wings on the same bird. And I think perfect example of that is the eulogies for John McCain and how you had President Obama speaking, you had Biden speaking, and they're all talking about Saint John McCain. And what I found in all of that is it's really those who represent empire speaking on behalf of empire, because they're validating. And this is not a judgment of John McCain. I just look at his record and he represented empire. He didn't see a war he didn't like. Jimmy Carter called him a warmonger. He chastised Barack Obama because Barack Obama's wars weren't big enough. So to me, when you have Biden, Obama, you've got what's his name from New York, from the Senate, the Democrat from the Senate, wanted to rename the Russell Building after John McCain.
Yeah, Chuck Schumer.
Chuck Schumer. This is, to me, all of the protectors of empire protecting the narrative of empire. Your thoughts?
Okay, well, you know, I think that's a good scenario. I think he laid it out. I just want to add one other thing. You mentioned the funeral of John McCain. I'd add something else that kind of flew a little bit under the radar scope this week, but I think bears a minute or two to pay attention to. Chuck Schumer. Now, Chuck Schumer met with Mitch McConnell, and I looked at some of the pictures. They looked awful chummy. They were smiling, handshakes. They just cut a deal. When I say they, really the Democrats just cut a deal with the GOP to allow and move ahead on 15 appointments that Trump made to the federal judiciary, as we well know, attacking the federal judiciary with hardcore, ultra-conservative, almost neo-fascist, anti-everything that's progressive, or even smacks at having a bit of liberalism to it. It would take too long to go through the long litany, but I think we know what they are of issues. So he's doing that. What struck me is, and I thought, well, wait a minute, if the script was flipped and it was on the other side, and you had, say, a Obama, and we already know what happened there, with 15 judicial picks, would McConnell have said, okay, we'll just move them right through? But what I thought was very interesting about when you mentioned before, really two sides of the same coin, you had these two chummy guys, the Senate minority leader, the Senate majority leader, cutting this deal, looking very chummy, looking very comfortable, looking very collegial with each other. That, to me, when I saw that picture and then how they cut the deal, told me all I needed to know. I want to go back to Florida 1 second of the question you asked before.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Gillum, I think we need to pay attention to him. I think we really need to pay a lot of attention to him. I saw the interview that he did, and I usually don't watch all of these things. I mean, it's too much for my stomach to take. I watched the entire interview that he did with Fox News. I said Fox News, not MSNBC or CNN, but Fox. I like what he said and how he handled it. They tried to kind of trip him up on a few points. He stayed on point. He said exactly what has been said already. I won because I stayed with the issues. They even tried to bring in when DeSantis, you know, used the racial pejorative.
We're going to get to that in a minute.
About monkey. But he didn't go with that.
Mm-hmm.
He brushed that off and he said, you know what? We're not here to talk about that. I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about Medicare for all. I'm here to talk about a living wage for all. I'm here to talk about a corporate tax that will pay for all of this. I'm talking about putting people back to work. And, you know, with all the issues, I'm talking about rebuilding public education. This is what I'm going to campaign on. This is what people want. You can call it leftist or progressive or whatever name you want. It doesn't matter. I won this primary based on that. So I think when I heard that, I don't think I know, when I heard that, I said, keep an eye on him. He got two things right. One, what people are focusing on, first of all, the issues, not getting in the gutter with the Trump stuff. And then the second thing is how to move people within the Democratic Party into the Democratic Party if they're paying attention.
Ray Baker?
Biggest thing, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Biggest thing, Dr. Leon, to consider, particularly regarding Mr. Gillum, is that black organizations, black political organizations did amazing groundwork for Andrew Gillum. The collective pack done by Quentin James and Stephanie Brown James. Stephanie Brown James, a Howard alum, so of course, as a fellow Howard person, I'm always going to shout her out. They did amazing, knocking on over 800,000 doors, placing over 50,000 calls, the type of work that we think here in this new age doesn't get the job done in politics. As we know, in politics, you either have the people or you have the money. And if Andrew Gillum was not going to have the money, it was impending upon him to have the people. And he employed black political consultants that went in and did the organizing, did the networking, did the grassroots work that you needed to do in order to reach the type of folks you need to reach in order to win statewide. Also, a last point I want to consider, particularly when we think about some of those who are on the ballot, African-Americans on the ballot across states, that includes Jealous in Maryland, that includes Abrams in Georgia and Gillum in Florida. The political scientist Raphael Sonnenschein, excuse me for mispronouncing his last name, says that in order for blacks to win statewide, there has to be a particular and unique political climate. We saw it in 2008. Do we get a Barack Obama if we don't have George W. Bush? Here now in 2018, we're seeing all sorts of Americans who are repulsed by what President Trump offers, turning to black candidates to almost, in some ways, be the political savior.
Great, great point. Great point. Two things I want to touch on quickly. One, Trump warns evangelicals of violence if Democrats win back the House. Trump warned evangelical leaders in a closed-door meeting that there would be violence if Republicans lose the House in November. Quote, they will overturn everything that we've done, and they'll do it quickly and violently and violently. There's violence. When you look at Antifa and you look at some of these groups, these are violent people. The level of hatred, the level of anger is unbelievable. Part of it is because of some things that I've done for you and for me and for my family, but I've done them. Caleb, your thoughts?
Well, you know, if you add to that that this morning we saw Trump tweet out that he was going to campaign for his old arch nemesis, Ted Cruz, and that he's going to work to get Ted Cruz reelected. Ted Cruz himself.
Wait a minute. Is that the same Ted Cruz with the ugly wife and whose dad helped to assassinate John Kennedy? Is that the same Ted Cruz?
One and the same.
Oh, okay. Just wanted to be sure I had him right, because that's what Donald Trump told me, that Ted Cruz's wife was ugly and that his dad shot John Kennedy. Okay, go ahead.
Sure. And I feel like, you know, those words when he's up there, he said it's going to be violence, violence, lots of violence. These groups are violent. They're going to overturn everything violently. There's an element of desperation there. And I mean, it's widely understood that Donald Trump is not exactly, you know, he hasn't exactly lived the lifestyle that a lot of evangelicals really would like to live and would like their kids to live. And he's not exactly the ideal role model that a lot of evangelicals would like their kids to be like. And that he really needs those folks to come out and support him. And that, you know, the Bush White House was very good at mobilizing the Christian right. And that the Trump White House, it needs the support of the Christian right, but it has a little bit of a problem. And that also a lot of the new right wing folks are, you know, more in line with Trump than they are with the Christian right. And that the Christian right, you know, it's not a secret that both times Barack Obama ran, he got a very significant amount of the Christian evangelical vote. And that as a voting bloc that just, you know, votes with the Republican Party, is loyal to the Republican Party. I mean, the Reagan and Bush, you know, era has come to an end. And, you know, Mike Pence was very much selected, I'm convinced, because he was an evangelical. And we've got, you know, the daughter of Mike Huckabee, you know, now acting as the White House press secretary and representing the White House in the media. And there's an effort to court what is a faction or a constituency within the Republican Party and keep them loyal to an individual and a character that is just not very appealing to evangelicals.
Earl, your thoughts?
Well, that's there, but I'm not convinced that in 2018 and certainly in 2020 that we'll see a repeat of what we saw in 2000 and 2004, when you really did have a major mobilization by Bush both times. And they were fundamental, literally fundamental, the fundamentalist Christian evangelicals, you know, and putting them over the top. I think their power is declining. And I think there is an element of desperation even within that movement. You've got a lot of divisions among the evangelicals. You've got a lot of drop-offs from that movement. There have been polls and surveys that have shown the numbers aren't there like they were 10 years ago. You got a lot of people that are not. As we know, the demographics are radically changing in America. A lot of people have turned off the church, period. So all of these things, I think, taken together, I'm not absolutely convinced the evangelicals are going to be the major force for Trump that they once were. He'll continue to rev them up. He'll continue to send signals with his judicial picks, always promising I'm going to get a guy or a woman on there that's going to overturn Roe versus Wade, because as you well know, I mean, they got a fetish about that. So he'll continue to do that. But again, how big a factor will they be in 2018 and 2020? Only time will tell. I'm not convinced they'll be the same that they were 10 years ago.
Ray?
Well, first, I want to push back a little bit on what Caleb said. And he said that Barack Obama did well among evangelicals. I don't know if I would necessarily use the language well. He did slightly better than 25% in 2008 and slightly better than 20% in 2012. And the reason why I call those numbers up and the reason why I bring that to our attention is that in United States politics, everything, unfortunately, is tied to race, right? Even when folks are thinking they're not talking about race, they're talking about race. And so for a white evangelical base to go 80% for Donald Trump, a man who called the second book of Corinthians 2 Corinthians, there has to be no reason for that allegiance than for the sole purpose of their racial allegiance to them, right? Because folks love being Christian. They also love being white more in the United States. Now, to Brother Hutchinson's point, whether or not white evangelicals will have the clout, the meaning that they once had, that remains to be seen. I do think that many people, if Donald Trump were able to galvanize a meaningful and sincere religious argument, I do think he would be able, in addition to the racial politics that I already referenced, to make the evangelical bloc relevant. What relevant means and how that looks percentage-wise, I'm not in a position necessarily to offer a quandary. But I do think he can make that relevant. But he lacks, my words, no one else's, the phony charisma of George W. Bush to at least appear to be a Christian like them.
Let's quickly move to DeSantis and his monkey. Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gilliam, who is African-American, wins the Democratic primary for Florida, for Florida's governor. His Republican challenger, DeSantis, goes on Fox and says, quote, "Let's build off the success we've had on Governor Scott. The last thing we need to do is to monkey this up by trying to embrace a socialist agenda with huge tax increases and bankrupting the state." I'll give my position on this before I go to my panel. The discussion has been now, was DeSantis using a racial reference in saying, monkey this up? I believe he was, and here's why. I have never heard anybody in this country use that phrase, monkey this up. I've heard people use variations of it. Don't monkey around with this. I've heard that. I've never heard anybody say monkey this up. That is not American vernacular. That is not standard American phrasing. So I believe he went outside the vernacular, and I haven't heard anybody else say this. In fact, I've heard conservatives who want to support him say, oh, well, people say monkey around all the time. But that's not what he said. I've heard people say, don't monkey with this all the time. That's not what he said. He said, monkey this up. I have never in my 59 years, and if any of you all in your time on this planet have heard somebody say what he said, then I'll stand corrected. But I have never heard anybody whose primary language is English say that. So, yeah, he was speaking to a particular constituency and using their language of preference to refer to Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gilliam. Caleb, your thoughts?
Oh, I agree with you. I mean, and what's interesting is that, you know, if he had directly called his opponent that, that would be very obvious what he was doing, and that would be, you know, straight up. But he did it in kind of a sly way, where he didn't directly call his opponent that. He used a phrase, and of course he's going to say, "Well, I didn't mean that." But the people that he would appeal to by using that kind of phrase are going to hear it and like him for it, and then he has deniability. And this is, you know, they talk about the Southern strategy, they talk about dog whistling. I mean, this is a common tactic. You use code words, you throw something in there. You know, I mean, people talk about when Trump said bad hombres, for example, during the debate. Mm-hmm. But what I think is more interesting is that, you know, among these far-right elements that are gaining traction among certain circles of the Trump supporters, there's a revival of kind of, you know, this what they call like biological racism, or, you know, the racial pseudoscience that was pushed by the British Empire back in the 1800s. And that actually, you know, this racial slur, I mean, it was rooted in the British Empire trying to justify its colonial atrocities by invoking, you know, theories of evolution and such. And they used it against all kinds of people they were colonizing. I mean, they used it against people in Asia. They used it against people in Ireland. And it was rooted in an attempt to justify the horrendous crimes of the British Empire with colonialism, slaughtering people en masse, in the name of, well, this is all just a big eugenics project. We're just trying to breed perfect people. And, you know, that stuff has been so thoroughly and widely debunked by any serious biologist and anyone who knows anything about anthropology and history and culture. But it's interesting that certain people really want to believe that kind of garbage and are trying to revive it to justify the bigoted feelings that they have.
Earl, and let me say, your view of history is a little longer than mine, which is a very nice way of saying you're a little older than me. So if you've heard this phrasing, if you've heard this particular phrasing, then monkey this up, then let me know. But I've never heard it.
Well, I guess we'd have to bring in our resident expert on that, Roseanne Barr. Ask her. Maybe she can shed some light on that. Look, you don't have to go as far as the British Empire. You don't have to go any further than Donald Trump. If my memory serves me correct, all Donald Trump did was during the campaign in 2016, he borrowed literally the page, the playbook, a big page from the playbook of the GOP of the last 35 years. Going all the way back to Richard Nixon, they figured out early on, we cannot come out and say, you know, we got to segregate the blacks over here. We cannot say segregation now, segregation forever. So here's what we'll do. We'll say permissiveness. We'll say crime in the streets. We'll say law and order. We'll say family breakdown. We'll use every code word, every code phrase, every code idea to mean one thing. Those people, and everybody knows when they speak to the base who those people are. African-Americans, number one, always number one. Hispanics, LGBT, and we go down the checklist. Anybody that's not them. So when we go to a DeSantis, using that term, of course he knew what he was doing. And by the way, there's even further proof of that, Wilmer, to back your point up. He didn't apologize.
There you go.
Walk it back. No, he didn't say anything. He was called out on it. And he just blew by it. And he said, I said what I said. So he already knew that it played to the gate, played to the base, had the effect, the desired effect that he wanted. And expect more of that. This is only the opening gun. You're going to see much more of that, not just the DeSantis from him. You're going to see it from all of them, because that's a card they have continually played for 45 years. And I got to tell you, in the election of Donald Trump, the election of Ronald Reagan, the election of Richard Nixon, and George H.W. Bush to an extent, and George W. Bush to a lesser extent, it's worked.
Ray Baker.
Ashe, Brother Hutchison, Ashe. I was just going to add George W. Bush to that, because he talks about the soft bigotry of low expectations and using his own way of saying, look, we're conservatives, but we care about the blacks, as we will do everything in our power policy-wise that will ultimately work against those people. I'm glad you included that. What I'm also interested in, I would love to, and I know the brother's a little older now, so I don't want to put any taxing work on him. I would love to have a linguistic expert, a person who studies this in this way, like Reverend Jeremiah Wright or someone of the sort, take a look at the words or even those phrases, monkey around or monkey anything, right? To see if even if we unpack those a little bit, do we find that it has the racist underbelly we might suspect it has? Because I'm not so convinced that even the phrases that we even know and recognize, that those don't already carry with them the baggage of racism. Because in the United States, what doesn't?
I just remember former Venezuelan President Chavez saying, George Bush is as dangerous as a monkey with a razor blade. I'll always laugh about that. Earl.
One's on that.
Oh, boy.
Earl, you have a book out on Kavanaugh called The Kavanaugh Court. What is the basis of your book? And explain to people how they can get it.
Well, as we well know, on a Tuesday, if they don't change it, but at least now officially it's scheduled for Tuesday, the opening of Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court of the United States. Chuck Grassley, who is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he's already said, we got enough documents. The Democrats have said, we want more. He said, we've got enough. We're going to go ahead with it. We're going to try to fast track this thing. We're going to have a vote by October. I think it would be well for all of us, anyone who has even a tiny bit of concern about the future of this country, to take a close look at this guy. I tried to do that in a small way in the Kavanaugh Court. I tried to look at his record. I tried to look at what we know about his record. I tried to look at many of the consequences, the implications, and many other things about him if he's on the court, and really what it means in terms of law and public policy in this country. Let's remember, he will be that fifth vote. And that great line, if we have five votes, conservatives have said this from in the millennial. If we have this fifth vote, we can do anything. Well, Kavanaugh represents the fifth vote. He's the ultra-conservative dream to roll back everything going back in time, almost the whole 20th century. So we have to be very clear. This is a major, major one. And by the way, one other thing, it just came out today. It just broke. Turns out that Kavanaugh, when he was a consul to George Bush, he made a recommendation, and he fought very hard. Emails just came out. It just broke a few minutes ago. Emails were released today about how he pushed the Bush administration to appoint Charles Pickering, who was a hardcore Mississippi upfront segregationist, to the bench. Very intimate and revealing email. So we've got over a million documents that they will not release the National Archives because of them. Grassley, McConnell are suppressing them. What else do we need to know about this guy? Very, very dangerous. This is the most dangerous SCOTUS pick that's come down the pike in decades.
Wow. Ray, quickly, you got about a minute.
You know, brother Leon, that's hard to hear and receive, not out of disbelief to Brother Hutchinson, but because we heard and knew the same thing was true when they put Samuel Alito before us. We heard and knew the same thing was true when Neil Gorsuch came before us. And to hear yet again, we're facing one of the most dangerous ones. It feels like every 5 or 10 years, we're facing the most dangerous conservative to come to the bench.
And they're trying to get this done by October because I think they are really fearful about having a Supreme Court having to deal with the question of what are we going to do if they start talking about impeachment, or if Mueller decides, A, through his report, he wants to pursue criminal charges, or if he decides to leave it in Congress's hands and a Democratic House decides to pursue it. Caleb, quickly, your thoughts.
There's going to be a lot of pressing issues on the hands of the Supreme Court in the coming years, whether it's, you know, gun control, which continues to come up over and over again as we see these mass shootings. You know, there's going to be, you know, questions about states and how much independence they have from the federal government and what can and cannot be imposed on them. And there's going to be a lot of pressing issues as the country gets more culturally and politically divided in response to the growing situation. So I think that this is vitally important, and we'll have to see what happens with Kavanaugh. I mean, if he gets through, that'll certainly be a victory for the Donald Trump Republican Party base.
Caleb Maupin, Earl Ofari Hutchinson, Ray Baker, thank you all. You all brought it today. You really brought it strong, as you always do. I greatly, greatly appreciate y'all's time. Have a wonderful, safe holiday. Thanks, fellas.
You were saying.
Thanks, fellas. Hey, folks, you need to do me a favor. You need to do yourselves a favor. You need to do your friends a favor. You need to tell everybody Radio Sputnik is where they need to tune to get serious, clear analysis. Talk without analysis is just chatter. And we don't chatter on Radio Sputnik. This is where you all need to turn. This is what you all need to listen to. This is what you need to do. Oh, sorry for the Facebook interruption. To my Facebook fans, hey, thank you all for tuning in. We greatly, greatly appreciate it. But again, you need to tell your friends, because this is where the real information comes from. This is what we do. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I want to thank you all again for tuning in here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe, peace, and blessings. Have a fantastic, safe holiday. I'm out.